So I want to pick up where we left off last time. It absolutely is not necessary for any of you to have been here participating in the last shiur, but let me just try to connect the dots between what we discussed last time and what I want to discuss this morning. So what we discussed last time was the way in which the rabbis responded to the destruction of the temple, the loss of the Korban Pesach, of the sacrifice of the Pesach on the night of the 15th of Nisan, where the dilemma was how exactly to replace what had been the centerpiece of the ritual on that night. What we looked at the passage in Philo, the biblical Sukkim as well, but passage in Philo, which focuses almost exclusively on the sacrifice and even seems to go as far as to suggest that they were bringing, you know, some sort of, whether it was a quasi-sacrifice or whether they imagined it in those terms, but that was really the focal point. What exactly happens after the year 70 CE when there is no more temple, there's no more opportunity for sacrifice? What exactly will this momentous occasion, and again, what we know is that of the rituals that we observe on the Jewish calendar, certainly I think we would regard the Seder as among the most important, among the most widely practiced. So what exactly was their ritual on this night going to look like? We discussed the fact that this was a perennial problem for the rabbis. It was a problem that we saw maybe most poignantly expressed in the passage in the Tosefta, in which, Jay, do you want to just share, share the sources? So let me just clarify. Unlike last time, the sources that you will be looking at are identical to the sources that I will be sharing. I learned my lesson. So the lesson that we were describing last time, I think just in terms of how the rabbis responded to the destruction, I think is a pervasive problem that was really poignantly expressed in the passage in the Tosefta, which describes the proliferation of ascetics in Israel following the destruction of the temple. Rabbi Yoshua has a conversation with them in which he challenges them and says, look, it's completely impossible for us to remain paralyzed. And so we need to figure out a way to incorporate these small but regular and daily practices that will really remind us of the temple, but that will allow us to progress into the future. And it's what Rabbi Yoshua there refers to as Zecher Yerushalayim. It's not trying to appropriate practices of the past and figure out how to sanitize them into a post-temple period. But what it's trying to do is to say, look, we need to move on while also not forgetting the past. We talked about the fact that Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai takes a slightly different approach. And again, it's not going to be a universal approach. It's only going to apply in particular circumstances. Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai's approach that we saw in the Mishnah is not Zecher Yerushalayim, these perennial, but at the end of the day, small reminders of what we've lost. Zecher LeMikdash, which is the way that Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai formulates his idea, is actually the idea that we can perpetuate the practices of the past. Again, not universally, but wherever possible, we can continue practicing the rituals that had been done in the temple. He focuses specifically on the practice of bringing Lulav and Etrog all 7 days outside of the Beit HaMikdash, which we know was not the practice during the time of the temple. During the time of the temple, outside of Yerushalayim, they would only bring the Lulav and Etrog one day out of Sukkot. And Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai's point is, look, wherever possible, let's try and hold on to the past. And in that way, what Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai really is doing is saying that we want to, rather than simply moving on, Rabbi Yoshua's approach, we want to try and hold on to the past as much as possible. And we talked about two different ways, really, in which the rituals on the night of the 15th really, I think, illustrate these competing perspectives. Do we try and perpetuate the practices of the past, carrying them on to the extent that we can? Or do we say we're going to try to institute new practices, maybe that are rooted in the past, but that are fundamentally going to be appropriate in this post-temple period? The practice that is most similar to that of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai on the night of the 15th is the practice that we saw is known as the Gedi Mikulas, the helmeted kid, which is prepared in every way like the Korban Pesach. And Rami Gamliel's point there was that there are certain aspects of the Korban Pesach that allow us to continue bringing it in the present. That we contrasted with a different approach that, again, Rami Gamliel also seems to kind of try to perpetuate, which is not the practice of bringing a quasi-Korban Pesach, this Gedi Mikulas, but rather trying to argue that the Korban Pesach was never simply an act. It was never about consuming a Korban. It was about appreciating the symbolism of the actions. And we spoke about how part of what Rami Gamliel does is actually not highlight the Korban Pesach as the centerpiece, but rather situating it alongside Maror and Matzah as a sort of triumvirate of different practices whose symbols are what are important rather than simply their consumption. For that perspective, we said, for the perspective that that tries to move on from what we had in the Second Temple period, we said that that approach maybe finds its most complete expression in the Mishnah, which focuses on Sipur Yetziat Mitzrayim, the telling of the story in which all of the foods, including the Korban Pesach, really were not, they weren't focused on consuming the Korban Pesach. They weren't even important as symbols. Rather, they were brought to the table as props, ritual props that were meant to provoke the initial questions that would then lead into the story itself. So those were the two competing perspectives, Sipur Yetziat Mitzrayim, Gedi Mikulas, that we talked about last time. What I want to speak about today is a third approach to how the rabbis responded to the loss of the Korban Pesach. And that is, rather than telling the story on the night of the 15th, for this perspective, the rabbis were instead studying the laws of the Korban Pesach. Now, in terms of, let me just introduce what this perspective entails. In speaking about the rabbis as studying the laws of the Korban Pesach, that's a familiar idea from elsewhere in rabbinic literature, namely the fact that the study of Torah is in some way a surrogate for the bringing of Korbanot and for the practice in the temple. The idea that in the aftermath of the destruction, the way that the rabbis put it, is that Ein lo lahakadosh baruch hu ela dalad amot shel halacha bilvad. And in the aftermath of the destruction, halacha is really the only way in which we reach God. And as a sort of complementary idea, the idea that when two people are studying Torah together, the divine presence rests among them. Again, the way in which we reach the divine presence is by study of Torah in the present time. What we're going to see today, I think, then, is that on the night of the 15th as well, we have this idea, not that the ritual is supposed to completely shift away from the consumption of the Korban Pesach to a telling of the story, but rather that there is an appropriation of the past in part by recounting the halachot. And in that way, we can't necessarily eat the Korban Pesach. It's not going as far, perhaps, as Rabbi Gamliel did in arguing that we should bring a Gedi Mikulas, but rather what we should be doing in the present is studying the halachot, and in that way, sort of engaging in a practice that is an appropriate substitute for Korbanot in the present time. So that's where I want to go today. Along the way, we're going to see important texts that contrast these two models of Sipur Yetziat Mitzrayim is what we're engaged in on the night of the 15th, and Talmud Torah, the study of Torah, as the ideal ritual on the night of the 15th. Okay, so let's get started. Is the screen large enough? Do I need to?
I would make it slightly larger. I don't think you need the stuff on the left. If you've got okay. The pages, sort of, you know, but it's readable. But if you can make it a little larger, even better.
Let me see if I can.
Yeah.
Okay, so if you can just bear with me for 1 second. Sorry about this.
I mean, it's fine. I don't know if there's any way to get rid of, you know, like we're saying on the left, you've got the actual pages sort of in miniature.
Yeah. I'm really, okay.
If not, it's not a big deal. I can read it and okay. I hope other people can too, but.
Okay. I will, I think there's an easier way. I'm sorry if everybody has to see my screen while I'm doing this. We'll be on our way in a second.
Put it in presentation mode. Put your slides in presentation mode.
Put my slides in presentation.
Or pinch it out. I pinched it out. So I don't know.
Yeah, but for those who want to watch, you know, on the screen.
Okay. Okay. Give me 1 second. I'm sorry.
Just click up on the magnification line on the top line there. It's page 108. It says 100. Just crank it up from 100 until it fills the reading.
Okay. What's the feature?
It's under where it says options.
Mm-hmm. I got it.
Everybody's waiting in, you know, eager silence.
Well, and we can also open it up in the chat.
Yeah, of course. There we go.
Good now? Okay.
Yeah. Okay.
Better?
Yes, that's great. That's great. Let's go. Great. Okay, beautiful.
Okay, so I want to start by looking at a passage in the Mechilta of Rabbi Yishmael. The Mechilta of Rabbi Yishmael is a Tannaitic worth work of Midrash. Let's call it sometime toward the beginning of the 3rd century CE. So again, to situate ourselves chronologically, we're talking about, let's call it approximately 150 years after the destruction of the temple. This passage should be relatively familiar because it's the Midrash about the four sons. I'm going to translate it as the four sons because, again, trying to channel the rabbinic worldview, Baniim presumably would have been for them sons, but again, as Jay said before, certainly we would want to translate it today as children. Okay, so we have then the familiar version. Again, we're going to see certain differences here, but at least the framework should be relatively familiar. We're going to start with the Chacham, the wise child, at the top. Chacham Mahu Omer, Ma Ha'edot V'Hachukim. Afata pitachlo bihilchot ha-pesach, amorlo ein machtirin achar ha-pesach afikoman. Okay, so again, the should be a relatively familiar question and answer from the Haggadah. Again, we'll talk about the difference, maybe the slight difference between this formulation and the more familiar one from the Haggadah in a little bit. If you take a look at the biblical verse, which is on the left-hand side of the page, so on the right-hand side, we have the question of what are these laws? You are supposed to pitachlo bihilchot ha-pesach. Pitachlo probably doesn't mean something like open with, but when we talk in rabbinic literature about pitach lit something, typically it means you should teach or suggest something. So here it would mean something like you should teach him hilchot ha-pesach, the laws of Pesach. And we'll come back to that second line about ein machtirin achar pesach afikoman in a minute, but let's just take a look at the biblical verse upon which the Chacham's question is based. The Chacham's question is based on the pasuk in Dvarim Perek Vav, Ki shalcha vincha machar lemor, when your child will one day ask you, Ma ha'edot v'hachukim v'hamishpatim, what are these testimonies, these laws and these statutes, asher tziva Hashem Elokeinu etzchem, that your God has commanded you. Now, the answer to this question in the Torah is different than the answer that we give to the Chacham.
Our God.
Say it again.
Elokeinu, our God.
Correct. Right. Our God. Sorry, did I say your God? Okay. Thank you. Okay. So you're supposed to say to the child, Avadim hayinu lefaro b'mitzrayim. we were slaves to Paro in Mitzrayim, and God took us out of Mitzrayim with a mighty hand. Now, just notice the answer to the question in the Bible, Avadim Hayinu, is actually not given to any of the children. Of course, we know that Avadim Hayinu is a passage that we recite at greater length in the Haggadah in general, not in response to any of the children. The answer that we give in response to the question of Ma Ha'edot, and again, I'm leaving the word Ma untranslated for a moment, the answer to the question of Ma Ha'edot in the case of the Chacham in the Mechilta is something about teaching the child Hilchot HaPesach related to this law, Ein Machtirin Achar HaPesach Afikoman. Now, in the biblical verse, Ma Ha'edot, what are the testimonies, does not mean what are they. It's not asking for an enumeration of the various laws. Ma Ha'edot means why do we practice these laws, right? Or if we want to keep the translation of what, it means what are the reasons for these laws. And you can confirm that that's the correct translation simply by the answer. The answer is because God took us out of Egypt. The answer, therefore, fits the question of either why do we do these laws, or instead, what is the purpose underlying these laws? That's not the way in which the Mechilta translates the word ma in what are the testimonies. And again, you can see that by the answer to the question. The answer to the question of teach the Chacham the laws of Pesach means that the way that the Haggadah, or the way that the Mechilta in this case, understands Ma is asking for an enumeration. What are the laws of this night? Very different translation that will yield a different type of answer. Now, it's noteworthy that the Mechilta chooses to translate Ma in Ma Ha'edot, not in terms of why or what are the reasons, but rather what are the laws. It's noteworthy because if we look at how the Chilta adapts the question from the Torah of Maha Avodah HaZot Lachem, there the Mechilta does actually translate the word Ma correctly. On the left-hand side of the screen, you see that the question that gets attributed to the Rasha is to the wicked son, V'haya ki yomru aleichem b'neichem, Maha Avodah HaZot Lachem. One day your children will ask you, what is this sacrificial ritual? And you're supposed to answer that question by describing the fact that God in Egypt passed over the houses of the Israelites. So it's clear from the biblical verse that Ma Ha'avodah, attributed to the child in that case, means why do we engage in this ritual? When we look at the question attributed to the wicked child on the right-hand side of the page, you can see that Ma Ha'avodah HaZot Lachem is translated correctly as why do we do this? And again, you can see, again, yes, not why do we do this, why do you do this? But it's clear that the Mechilta is translating the word Ma as not what are they or what are the details of this ritual, but why do we engage in this ritual? And you can see that, again, by the answer. The answer fits the understanding of the question, namely, we engage in this ritual because God took us out of Egypt. So the question then is, why does the Mechilta correctly understand the word Ma when adapting the question in the case of the wicked child, but seems to misconstrue the word Ma in adapting the question for the wise child, for the Chacham? So I think the answer is that when the authors of the Mechilta hear the words Ma Ha'edot V'Hachukim, what are these? What are the testimonies and the statutes? They naturally hear not what are the reasons for, but what are they? And the reason that they naturally hear that to them is translated as what are they is because for the authors of the Mechilta, for the rabbis responsible for this text, their practice on the night of the 15th was not, at least for the wise people, was not necessarily recounting the story, but rather studying the law, studying the halachot. And therefore, it was natural, it almost subconsciously, they naturally would have understood the question of Maha Eidot, even if it's perhaps a distortion of the plain sense meaning of the Pasuk, but they naturally would have filtered their understanding of that question through the lens of their experience of studying the laws on the night of the 15th. So this is the first, I think, the first hint at the fact that not only was the practice on the night of the 15th for some involving the study of the laws, but that it just would have been the natural way of reading these psukim to match their experience on the night of the 15th. We want to get a confirmation that this was not just a theoretical attribution of this question to the Chacham, but that the question of the Chacham actually matches actual practice. We have to look at another text, and this one is from the Tosefta. Tosefta and the Mechilta, basically both works of the Tanaitic period. Again, let's date them approximately the same time to around the beginning of the third century, again, about 150 years after the destruction of the Second Temple. We see at the top here in the Tosefta, Ein Maftirin Achar HaPesach HaKipoman. And again, that was a passage that we saw as the answer to the question of the wise child, which we'll come back to just trying to unpack what exactly that phrase means. Here, Ein Maftirin Achar HaPesach HaKipoman is understood to mean that we don't eat in the aftermath of the Korban Pesach. We don't eat what you have here in the English translations. We don't eat dainties. And then we have what I think is the critical several paragraphs that are relevant to our immediate purposes. Chayav Adam La'asok B'Hilchot HaPesach Kol HaLaila. One is obligated to involve oneself in the study of Hilchot HaPesach the entire night. Now, as we'll see, it's clear that Hilchot HaPesach here doesn't mean the laws of Pesach. So, for example, we're not studying the laws of Matzah and Maror. What we mean when we speak of Hilchot HaPesach is we mean the laws of the Korban Pesach. You can just see that by comparing this second sentence with the sentence that preceded it. Ein maftirin achar HaPesach apikoman. HaPesach in that first sentence means after the consumption of the Korban Pesach, we don't do something called apikoman. So then in the second sentence, when we are told that one is obligated to study the Hilchot HaPesach, what that's referring to is the study of the halachot of the Korban Pesach on this night. Now, one is obligated, according to the Tosefta, even if one is just engaged with one's child, even if one has access to oneself, even if one only has access to one student. Meaning this is a universal ideal. What we do on the night of the 15th, according to this Tosefta, is not recount the story, but rather study the laws. Now, just notice the difference between the imperative in the Tosefta and what we just saw previously in the Mechilta's version of the four children, namely the fact that according to the Tosefta, this is not limited to only the wise. This is a universal imperative, Chayav Adam. Every person is obligated to study the laws of the Korban Pesach on this night. And so it's clear from the Tosefta, presumably these are mutually exclusive obligations. You're either studying the Hilchot HaPesach all night, or you are telling the story all night. Again, the Tosefta doesn't even raise the possibility that you would be telling the story. So these seem to be mutually exclusive and independent options for what the ritual on this night looks like. Now, the Tosefta, interestingly, goes on to give an actual case study that proves that one should be engaged in the study of the laws. But it's interesting, the participants in this ma'aseh, in this case study, are interesting. So ma'aseh b'Rabban Gamliel uzkenim shahayu misubin b'veit baitos ben zunin balu. Rabban Gamliel and the other elders were reclining in the house of baitos ben zunin in the city of Lud. V'hayu asukin b'hilchot ha'pesach kol ha'layla. And they were engaged in the study of Hilchot HaPesach, again, in the laws of the Korban Pesach, that entire night, ad krod hagever, until the cock crows. And then what happens? Higbihu milifnehen v'no adu v'halchu lahen levet hamidrash. The cock crows, they raise up the table in front of them, stretched, and went along to the study hall, to the Beit Midrash. A couple of things that are noteworthy about this particular episode. First of all, just notice the apparent gap between the universal imperative at the beginning of this Tosefta, Chayav Adam La'asok B'Hilchot HaPesach. Everyone is obligated to study the Hilchot HaPesach. And this case, in which we have not the commoners, but we have the wise and the sages who are engaged in the study of the Hilchot HaPesach. So I think there are at least two ways of explaining the apparent gap here between the universal imperative and what seems to be the sort of proof text from this story. One possibility is to see this ma'aseh, this story, as basically a statement of dissent, and to imagine that actually what we have here is we have two competing understandings of the scope of this imperative. The first possibility that is stated in the Tosefta is that this is actually a universal imperative. Everyone should be engaged in this identical practice of studying the laws of the Pesach. The case study is not meant as a proof, but rather as a challenge. And this is something that scholars recently have written about, namely the connection between narrative and law and the ways in which sometimes what you have in rabbinic literature is narratives that aren't meant to confirm the previous statement, but that are rather statements of dissent. This could be one such statement, namely where this ma'aseh, this case study, is meant to say this is not actually a universal imperative, rather this is something that should be limited only to the wise. And again, in that case, this would be channeling the version of the four children that we saw in the Mechilta, namely, this is something that is limited to the wise. That's one possibility for how to understand the relationship between the universal imperative and this case study. But I think maybe a more intriguing way of understanding the connection between these two passages is actually to say that what we learn from the ma'aseh, from this case study, is not that the sages are the ones who should be studying the Hilchot HaPesach, but even when the sages are engaged in the study, namely, even when they are doing on the night of the 15th, what they would do on a regular basis, even then their study is not the same as it usually is. Because what you see here is a movement from the home to the study hall, from the home to the Beit Midrash. They study Hilchot HaPesach all night, but then what happens when the cock crows, they get up and they go to the Beit HaMidrash. Which suggests that what the Tosefta might be saying is that even when scholars study on this night, as they always do, it's still a different type of study. It's still a type of study which is more universalizing, which is more democratic, which is not limited to the scholars. And therefore, even when scholars engage in study, it's as part of the family unit, or it's at least, even if they're not with family, there's at least a certain democratization, a certain leveling of the playing field. Everybody is supposed to be engaged, and even these chachamim are engaged in this practice in a way that distinguishes their practice from every other day, essentially. And maybe that's a more intriguing way of understanding it, in which case this case study actually does support the universal imperative. Scholars themselves do engage in their familiar practice, but in a way that reflects what is different about this night. Okay, so we have the Tosefta maybe as an extension, confirmation of what we suggested in connection with the question of the Chacham, namely that there was this practice of engaging in Torah study, but perhaps an expansion beyond the Mechilta to encompass everyone on this night. Now, what exactly is the purpose? Why would this be something that they would engage in? So here we have to go back to the Mechilta, because I think the Mechilta is very instructive. Okay, Davar Acher, asking. This is going to comment on the very same pasuk that we saw was the question posed by the Chacham. Maha idot v'achukim, what are the testimony, statutes, and ordinances? So this is a commentary on what that pasuk means. Rabbi Eliezer says as follows. Rabbi Eliezer omer, minayin ata omer, she'im haita chavura shel chachamim o shel tamidei chachamim, Tzrichim liyot yoshvin ve'uskin b'hilchot HaPesach ad chatzot. How do we know that a chavura, and again, that word will become important in a moment, but how do we know that a company of teachers or disciples who sit on the night of the 15th have to be engaged in the study of Hilchot HaPesach until chatzot, until midnight? That's the meaning of maha edot v'hachukim. Again, what the Mechilta is basically saying is, again, understands that question of ma ha'edot, in similar terms as the Mechilta elsewhere, namely, Maha Edot means not what are the reasons, but substantively, let's enumerate what those laws are. Let's study what those laws are. What's interesting about this passage is two things. First of all, the reference to these Chachamim who are sitting together as a Chavura, that's point number one. Point number two is the fact that they are studying until Chatzot. Now, why is it that those two data points within this passage are important? It's because both of those words, the reference to their sitting together as a Chavura and the reference to this study is lasting until Chatzot, we know are typical of how Rabbi Eliezer understood the Korban Pesach. According to Rabbi Eliezer in the next passage in the Mechilta, this is not in the immediately next passage in the Mechilta itself, but it's elsewhere. Rabbi Eliezer says, how do we know that you are only allowed to eat the Korban Pesach until Chatzot, namely not all night? Ne'emar kan laila, v'ne'emar lahalan laila. The first laila, namely in reference to the fact that the Torah says you eat the flesh of the Korban Pesach that night, and elsewhere, v'ne'emar lahalan laila. Later on, the Torah will say that on that night, God passes over the houses of the Israelites. Lahalan, ma lahalan ad chatzot, af kan ad chatzot. Just as later in reference to the movement of God through Egypt, that only took place until midnight, so too does the consumption of the Korban Pesach last only until midnight. So if we ask why it is that Rabbi Eliezer, in that first passage, says that you study the laws of Pesach until midnight, it's precisely because what we're doing in studying the laws is basically serving as the study serves as a surrogate for the consumption of the Korban Pesach. And so therefore we adapt the exact same laws that governs the consumption, also govern the study, which is basically a substitute in the presence. The reference to the group that is sitting there as a chavura also is a way of channeling the practice of the Korban Pesach into the present. The language of a chavura, that was how a group that sat together and eat the Korban Pesach was referred to. And this is just one representative example. Many other examples where the group that ate the Korban Pesach together was known as a chavura, as a fellowship, right? As a group of fellows. And again, we'll just read this, but straightforwardly, Tanu Rabbanan, Ketzad Shalola Ochlav, commenting on statements in the Mishnah that if you slaughter a Korban Pesach for those who cannot eat it, then the Korban Pesach is pasul. So who are these people who cannot eat it? So the Braita that is quoted in the Talmud Bavli here says, those who cannot eat it are those who are a choleh or those who are a zakein, those who are sick or those who are too old, those who are infirm, those who can't eat it simply because they're too old. In such cases, that's the category of people for whom you slaughter the Korban Pesach, for those who can't eat it. Ketzad shelo limnu yav, the second category given in the Mishnah, where if you slaughter the Korban Pesach, shelo limnu yav, for those who are not in some way registered for it, that too renders the Korban unfit for consumption. Nimnu alav chavurazo ushchato l'shem chavura acheret. So shelo limnu yav, namely slaughtering it for those who are not registered to eat, refers to the slaughtering of this Korban Pesach for a chavura, for a group of fellows who are not the group of fellows that had registered for it. Meaning you had in mind that this Korban Pesach would be designated for a chavura that was not the correct chavura, not the correct group of fellows. You see that the Korban Pesach was eaten among a group known as a chavura, so that again, when Rabbi Eliezer refers to a chavura of chachamim, who are engaged in the study of the Korban Pesach, the night of the 15th, what Rabbi Eliezer is capturing is that in some way, this study is meant as a substitute in the present, in the aftermath of the destruction, for the consumption of the Korban Pesach. That, therefore, is the logic of why we would study. Now, just to go back for a moment to the Tosefta, notice that the Tosefta said that a person should engage in the study of Hilchot HaPesach Kol HaLaila, not Ad Chatzot, and that's precisely because there's a machloket among the rabbis whether the Korban Pesach was eaten Ad Chatzot or whether it could be eaten all night. And apparently the Tosefta's version that says that we study the Hilchot HaPesach all night reflects the practice that the Korban Pesach would be eaten all night. Rabbi Eliezer, who says that we study only until Chatzot, is consistent with his position about the consumption of Korban Pesach lasting only until Chatzot. Now, just notice, again, if we think about the scope of this imperative, the scope of this imperative in this Mechilta is, again, different from that of the Tosefta. Here, it's not Chayav Adam, that everyone is obligated to engage in such a practice, but rather it's a Chavura of Chachamim or Talmidei Chachamim, only sages and only disciples of the sages who are engaged in this practice. This is actually, if we think about the scope of this imperative, this is actually the narrowest of all, narrower even than the Mechilta, which attributed this question and the answer to the wise child. Here, we're not even talking about a parent teaching a wise child the laws. Here, what we're talking about are adult sages and their disciples who are sitting around and studying. And so this, again, unlike the Tosefta and the story of Rabbi Gamliel, this is the sages and their disciples engaged in the routine practice every day and every night. They are sitting around studying halachot. What is unique about this night is not as in the Tosefta, the fact that their study moves from the Beit HaMidrash into the home. What is unique about their study on this night is the fact that they are studying a specific subject matter, namely the Hilchot HaPesach. And so what you see is this wasn't necessarily intended as a curriculum for all to follow. And so in a text like the Mechilta might have imagined that there might be two tracks. Those who are wise and their disciples engage in the familiar practice of Torah study. It's just that they focus on the study of the Korban Pesach. Those who are not necessarily intellectually equipped to study or don't necessarily have the educational background to do so, perhaps would be engaged in the recounting of the story. I think that it's the Tosefta that imagines these two imperatives, study or narrative, as really mutually exclusive. All people engage in one or the other. Not so for the Mechilta, clearly, and maybe not even so for the other version of the four children in the Mechilta, which speaks only about the wise child as engaged in this practice. Okay, I want to return to that question that the wise child poses that is answered with Ein Maftirin Achar HaPesach HaFikoman. Remember, the question of the wise child, what are these laws, is given a response of Ein Maftirin Achar HaPesach HaFikoman. What does that mean, Ein Maftirin Achar HaPesach HaFikoman? So the famous Talmud scholar of the 20th century, Saul Lieberman, taught Talmud for decades at the Jewish Theological Seminary, unpacked that word afikoman and connected it with a Greek practice known as epikomadze. So afikoman is basically a word borrowed from the Greek. Epikomadze is described maybe most fully in this passage from Plato's Symposium that describes what took place in one such epikomadze, one such setting where what we're going to see described is basically a sort of lighthearted, irreverent drinking fest that would take place in the aftermath of the meal with certain erotic overtones accompanied by music, and that also featured intellectual discourse, but intellectual discourse that, again, had sort of an irreverent, maybe even a slightly erotic overtone. And the point that the parent is going to make to the wise child is that on this night, we don't engage in such a practice. Let's just read about what this practice is to get a better sense of what exactly the wise child is being told we don't do on this night. Okay, so Plato writes as follows. After this, it seems, when Socrates had taken his place and had dined with the rest, so the meal has now ended, they made libation and sang a chant to the god and so forth as custom bids till they betook them to drinking. So what happens after the meal, people don't simply leave the table and go home. Rather, the night continues, but it continues with much more drinking. And it's clear that this wasn't just sitting around and drinking a little wine. And it's clear from what Pausanias responds. He opens a conversation and says, "Well, gentlemen, what mode of drinking will suit us best? For my part, to tell the truth, I am in very poor form as a result of yesterday's bout. I got completely drunk last night, and I claim a little relief. It is so, I believe, with most of you, for you were at yesterday's party. So consider what method of drinking would suit us best. So what you see from here is that this was a routine practice. Talks about the fact that this is now, they're doing this on consecutive nights. On consecutive nights, what follows this communal meal is sitting around and drinking until they get completely intoxicated. And on the second night, Pausanias says, I can't do again what we did last night. So what is going to happen? So a third member of this group, Eryximachus, says, since it has been resolved then that we are to drink only so much as each desires, we're not going to get completely drunk tonight. Let's only drink as much as we feel like we can tolerate with no constraint on any. I next propose that the flute girl who came in just now be dismissed. So normally there would be a woman who would come in with musical accompaniments. Again, there's not just music being played, but there are certain erotic overtones to this woman's presence. But now that we're not going to be getting completely drunk, let's dismiss her. And instead, let us seek our entertainment today in conversation. I am ready, if you so desire, to suggest what sort of discussion it should be. So what are they going to sit around and speak about? So they speak again in the next paragraph, the bolded section. So if you on your part approve, we might pass the time well enough in discourses. For my opinion is that we ought each of us to make a speech in turn from left to right, praising love as beautifully as he can. So what are they going to sit around and talk about in this post-dinner setting? They're going to sit and talk about praise to love. And each member of this party is going to declare a praise to love. There's a certain irreverence, a certain lightheartedness, a certain playfulness to the manner of their intellectual discourse, which is supposed to stand in contrast to the sort of somber and sacred setting that follows the eating of the Korban Pesach. Just to continue this passage in the bolded sentences in the final paragraph, to be sure, we who sit at the bottom do not get a fair chance, but if the earlier speakers rise nobly to the occasion, we shall be content. So now let Phaedrus, with our best wishes, make a beginning and give us a eulogy of love. So they may not even make it all the way around the table. We'll be happy if the earlier speakers speak in eloquent terms in their praise to love. What we mean then when we respond to the wise child's question of what are these laws? And we respond, Ein maftirin achar ha-pesach afikoman. What we're basically saying is, you want to know the answer to the laws? The answer is not, the single answer is not to teach that child, Ein maftirin achar ha-pesach afikoman, that in the aftermath of the Korban Pesach, we don't engage in this practice. But what we are instructed to teach the child is that that is the critical question of the night. At least for that child. The critical question of the night is, what are these laws? And so you, wise child, should know that is going to be the singular subject matter of our time together. We won't conclude our consumption of the Korban Pesach with the epikomazein, sitting around and engaged in lighthearted, irreverent intellectual discourse with certain sexual overtones in a sort of drunken stupor. Instead, what we're going to do is we are going to sit around and do exactly as you request. We are going to sit and study the laws. And so, again, you can understand just based on the answer that we give to the wise child, Ein maftirin achar ha-pesach afikoman, what we are telling the child is what is different about this night is our study of the law. The intellectual discourse in which we engage is fundamentally different on this night. And that's a way of sort of setting the tone for everything that's going to follow. Not limited to Ein Maftirin Achar HaPesach HaPikoman, but as the Mechilta said, Ach Atab Pitach Lo B'Hilchot HaPesach, you should teach that child, the wise child, Hilchot HaPesach. Not just that one law, that law is meant as a framing for everything that is going to follow. Now, just as a footnote back to what we discussed last week, remember we talked last week about a sequence of festive meals that included three phases. You had parparaot that preceded the meal, sort of appetizers, three sets of appetizers that would precede the main meal. And then you had parparaot that would follow the meal, namely these sorts of desserts or appetizers that would follow the meal. Those desserts or appetizers were meant to sort of stimulate one's thirst and that would then lead to drinking. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean in the case of the Mishnah that they anticipated this practice of epikomazein, but the idea that there would be drinking in the aftermath of the meal seems to be implied again in that Mishnah and the practices that we see there, in which case, just notice the way that the Tosefta understands afikoman. We did see the Tosefta defining afikoman, and we'll see a different definition of afikoman in a little bit. But when the Tosefta describes afikoman in the first sentence here, ein maftirin achar ha-pesach afikoman, kigon egozin tzmarim uplayot. That understanding of afikoman is not necessarily misguided. It's not necessarily different from the way that Professor Lieberman understood afikoman. But there, the idea is the beginning of the post-dinner drinking. And again, this doesn't mean that the rabbis necessarily understood that there would be this, drunken fest that would follow. But the idea that there would be appetizers that would stimulate one's thirst is maybe implied in that definition of the afikoman in the case of the Tosefta as well, in which case what the Tosefta is saying is precisely this idea that after the afikoman, chayav adam la'asok yolchot ha-pesach, that's what we're going to do tonight, and not this practice of eating appetizers after the meal. Okay, I want to compare the passage about the tradition of the four children in the Mechilta, which is what we looked at until now, with the parallel passage in the Talmud Yerushalmi, because what we're going to begin to see is a difference between this tradition focused on the recounting of the story, Sipur Yetziat Mitzrayim, what we spoke about last week, and Torah study, and the difference being that there are these two independent, perhaps within one household, you might have had some people engaging in one, some people engaging in the other, but the idea that there are these two possible practices, I think, comes out very nicely from the differences in this Braita of the four children in the Mechilta as opposed to the Talmud Yerushalmi. So moving on to the Talmud Yerushalmi, we're still within the context of Eretz Yisrael, but we're about 200 years later. Let's date the editing of the Talmud Yerushalmi to around the year 400 CE. So around 200 years after the Mechilta and the Tosefta, around 300 plus years after the destruction of the temple, same basic outline, but the questions and answers are going to be different. Just notice, just as a preliminary matter, the question that is attributed to the Chacham in the Yerushalmi, which is on the left, is the same question that's attributed to the Chacham in the Mechilta, but the answer is completely different. The answer to the Chacham in the Talmud Yerushalmi is, Af Atah Amorlo, say to him, Bechozek Yad Hotzianu Hashem Mitzrayim Beit Avadim, with a mighty hand, God took us out of Egypt from the house of bondage. Notice in the Mechilta and in the Haggadah, that answer is the answer that is given to the Tipesh. Again, the Tipesh is the way that we have it without the negative overtones of what we mean when we refer to somebody as a Tipesh. The Tam in our Haggadah, Tipesh in the Yerushalmi and the Mechilta, is the one who receives the answer to that question. Is the one who receives the answer of Bechozek Yad Hotzianu Hashem Mitzrayim. God took us out of Egypt with a mighty hand. What this means is that the Talmud Yerushalmi correctly understands that the question of Ma Ha'edot, what are the testimonies, not as meaning enumerate the various laws leading to this idea that what we do on this night is Torah study, which is what we saw in the Mechilta, and again, channeling the general practice of Torah study. What the Talmud Yerushalmi is doing is saying, Maha Edot means, why do we do those things? Again, consistent with the plain sense meaning of the biblical verse, why is it that the understanding of that question in the Yerushalmi would focus not on what are the laws, but why do we engage in these laws? Why do we engage in these practices? Precisely because the Yerushalmi is not focused on Torah study. The Talmud Yerushalmi is channeling a practice which is focused on telling the story. If you're telling the story, then even the Ben Chacham's question is not going to be fundamentally different. His question might be more sophisticated in some ways, might be more complex, But the answer is not fundamentally different. Just notice the answer will still focus on the reason for these laws. The question might be more sophisticated, but the practice of the night for all four children is going to focus on the recounting of the story. Torah study is not on the Yerushalmi's radar. Telling the story is the focal point of the night. Now, just as a, really, this is just in parentheses, but I just want to point out one of the perennial questions that we have on the Haggadah is why the difference between the question, the answer to the Chacham, the wise child, and the answer to the Rasha, the wicked child, if after all, the way that the Chacham phrases the question is, what are these laws to you, etchem? And of course, the Rasha poses the question of Maha Avodah Hazot Lachem, to you. Notice that the formulation of the Pasuk in the Talmud Yerushalmi is not Asher Tzivah Hashem Elokeinu etchem, you, but it's rather Asher Tzivah Hashem Elokeinu Otanu, us. Two possible explanations for why that would be. One could be simply that the formulation of the Pasuk has been changed precisely in response to that question. There has to be some sort of explanation for the distinction between the wise child and the wicked child. And so therefore, the question of the wise child is changed from Asher Tzivah Hashem Elokeinu Etchem, to you, to Asher Tzivah Hashem Elokeinu Otanu. But maybe the more interesting explanation is that we know that both the Greek and the Latin translations of this biblical verse, both the Septuagint, the Greek, and the Vulgate, the Latin translation, actually seem to have an underlying biblical text, which is not Asher Tzivah Hashem Elokeinu Etchem, but rather is Asher Tzivah Hashem Elokeinu Otanu. So it could be that the Talmud Yerushalmi has a biblical text which matches the biblical text underlying the Greek and the Latin, and their version of this list reflects that different biblical text. And the question, that perennial question of why the difference between the Chacham and the Rasha, only arises because our biblical text says etchem and lachem, whereas originally, perhaps, the question to the wise child would have been based on a biblical text that read otanu. So you have very nicely split. The Chacham's question is based on a text that reads otanu. The Rasha's question is based on the text that reads lachem. All that is really just kind of in parentheses. Okay, a couple of final points. What is the expected set of practices? Is the expected set of practices the obligation to tell the story, or is the expected practice the obligation to study these halachot? You can appreciate the difference between these two possibilities by comparing side by side the passage that we already read in the Tosefta and the familiar passage from the Haggadah. So the passage that we read in the Tosefta, all people are obligated to study the laws of the Pesach all night. Afilu beino levein beino, afilu beino levein atzmo, afilu beino levein talmido. Right? Whether one is sitting with one's child, whether one is sitting alone, whether one is sitting with one's student. Now, notice the parallel in the Haggadah on the left. Afilu kulanu chachamim, kulanu nivonim, kulanu zakenim, kulanu yodim et tatara. Regardless of who you are, even if you are a wise person, such that you have a student, right, in the version in the Tosefta, you are still obligated to recount the story of Sipur Yetziat Mitzrayim, not focused on the telling of the Hilchot HaPesach, but rather the recounting of the story. We actually have, the Talmud Bavli actually preserves a version of the Braita and the Tosefta that actually matches it much more closely. And there it's Chayav Adam Lisaper Bitziat Mitzrayim. I don't remember the exact formulation. Afilu Beino Levein Beino, Afilu Beino Levein Atzmo, Afilu Beino Levein Talmido. Namely, the Talmud Bavli has a version that basically replaces the reference in the Tosefta to the study of Hilchot HaPesach to the recounting of the story, because like the Haggadah, what we have is we have a different ideal, not focused on the study of the halachot, but rather focused on the telling of the story. And so therefore, whereas in one context, all people, including the wise, are expected to tell the story, in the other case, all people, not just the wise, are expected to study the laws. And I think maybe the starkest difference between the two comes through in, again, this familiar story that we know of in the Haggadah. We already read a parallel, and hopefully that should have provoked a question. Doesn't that story sound like the familiar one from the Haggadah with important differences? The version in the Haggadah has Rabbi Eliezer, Rabbi Yoshua, Rabbi Elazar, Ben Azariah, Rabbi Akiva, Rabbi Tarfon, all of these sages sitting in Bnei Brak and telling the story of Yitziat Mitzrayim all night until the morning, until they went, their students come to them and say, Higiat Zman Kriyat Shema Shel Shachari. That story parallels very closely the story that we read in the Tosefta, where you have these sages who are also gathered. There it's not reclining in Bnei Brak, it's reclining in Lud. But what they're doing is not telling the story, it's engaging in the practice of Pesach. The fact that you have this very different version of the story, basically identical with one primary substitute, which is not the study, but rather the telling of the story, suggests that what the Haggadah is doing is intentionally shifting the focus away from study and toward the telling of the story. What's important to observe in that regard is the fact that we actually don't have another reference to this ma'aseh in the Haggadah outside of the Haggadah. It's possible that it is, that it's a historical, that there's some sort of historical memory of such a story, but it's also possible that the Haggadah has simply adapted this ma'aseh from the Tosefta, but shifted it in line with its ideal set of practices, namely focused on the Sipur. Okay. Notice in that regard also the difference between these two stories. In the ma'aseh of Rabban Gamliel from the Tosefta, you have them getting up from the table in their home and going to the Beit Midrash. There's no reference in the version in the Haggadah to these people getting up and going to the Beit Midrash, because what they're doing on this night is fundamentally different from what they do on all other nights. There is no return to the Beit Midrash. There's only sitting and recounting the story. Okay, let me try to wrap up and try to synthesize what we've seen today and connect the dots to what we saw last time. So what we've seen today is a third possibility for how the rabbis responded to the destruction of the temple and the disappearance of the Korban Pesach. This is not continuing to actually consume a quasi-Korban Pesach, and it's not recounting the story, namely something that is really disconnected from temple ritual. This is connected with temple ritual, but what we have is a familiar replacement of temple ritual, of sacrifice, with study. And so this is sort of an intermediate possibility where there is a movement away from the past, Torah study, but at the same time, there's Torah study that is meant basically as a perpetuation of the past. We can't consume the Korban, but we can continue to study its laws. And in that way, the question that I posed earlier, namely how exactly were the rabbis going to respond, looking backward or looking forward, this is an interesting option that I think really bridges the gap between those two possibilities. I want to draw attention to one last point that I think unites our different discussions, which is the place of Rabban Gamliel. What we've seen is Rabban Gamliel's role in all three of those contexts. Rabban Gamliel was the one to whom the Mishnah attributed this practice of the Gedim Kulas, the helmeted kid. Rabban Gamliel, remember, was the one who also sat around the table and ascribed to the various foods symbolism, and in that way, as we said, reduced the significance of the Korban Pesach and elevated the significance of the other foods. And we also discover that it's Rabban Gamliel who is sitting around and engaged in the study of the Hilchot HaPesach. Interesting that Rabban Gamliel is desperately trying to formulate some sort of response that is creative in incorporating all of the different possibilities. He's both looking backward, looking forward, and also adopting this option that really effectively bridges the gap. Rabban Gamliel really is the one who, at least on the night of the 15th, was the one who was instrumental in formulating what the path forward would be in the aftermath of the destruction. Thank you very much. I will pause here. Anybody has any questions?
There are questions in the chat box if you want to take a quick look.
Sure.
A few comments and questions in the chat, and then we can get this any order.
Can I mention something?
Please. Please go ahead.
Oh, when you were talking about Chacham and then you said Kol Adam, so I always saw it that the four children, this status is actually in each one of us at a different time. At a certain time we can be Chachamim, at a certain time we can be Tam. So it's actually includes us in the four children, each one of us at a certain time in his life.
Very nice. I think that makes a lot of sense. Very nice. I like that a lot. Thank you. Just going down the chat quickly, question of which Rav Gamliel do I think it is? So that relates back to something that we discussed last week, which is, I think we're talking about Rav Gamliel II, the Rav Gamliel of Yavne, who postdates the destruction. You have to refer back to the shiur from last week. I think the recording is available on the website, so you can get a sense of why that would be. Learning about sacrifices as we do during Shacharit every day is ki'ilu, as if we offer the sacrifices, as Leviticus Rabbah explains. The Chavura and Bnei Brak, or the House of Baitus, are learning laws of Pesach in order to perform as if version of Pesach sacrifice. Exactly, right? I think that captures very well the argument that I was trying to make. Hallel instead of Afikoman confirms Lieberman's explanation of Afikoman. We dismiss the flute girls. Very interesting. I like that. Could our practice of engaging in singing of cute songs at the end of the Seder be considered as inappropriate? Ah, interesting. That is, we are not seeking our entertainment in conversation or engaging in other Torah study or the laws of the Pesach. I actually would suggest that actually what we're doing is, I don't think that this is really what we're doing. I don't think that that's the origin of those songs. Those songs were introduced into the Haggadot at a much later point, long after this practice of epikomadzein was familiar. But, you know, if you wanted to take the point a little bit further, you might say, look, that what we're doing is we're sanitizing that practice. So maybe we're not completely avoiding it, but what we're doing is this night is different than all other nights. So if one possibility is this night is different than all other nights in that we study Torah in the aftermath of the meal. For this practice, you might say this night is different than all other nights in that on other nights, perhaps we engage in irreverent singing. What we're doing on this night is we sing, and perhaps even we might characterize these as Ted said, as cute songs, but they're songs that have a sanctity to them. And in that way, we sort of sanitize and shift the focus away from irreverence towards sanctity. When was the Haggadah first read in history? So we don't have a way of knowing that. We have Haggadot that are Haggadot, especially from Eretz Yisrael, that are found in the Cairo Geniza. And so we're talking about probably 500, 600, 700 CE are probably the earliest manuscripts. Our earliest complete manuscripts, those are Eretz Yisrael Haggadot. The earliest version of a Babylonian Haggadah, which looks much closer to ours, is from Seder of Amram Gaon, but we certainly, in terms of us, if what you mean by when was the Haggadah first read in history, you mean the text of the Haggadah. So the Sipur Yetziat Mitzrayim that we're describing these texts probably would not have necessarily been something that in a Haggadah that approximated our Haggadah. So am I saying this is another version of which is more important, studying or doing? I'm not sure it's the same thing. That's an interesting formulation, but I don't think that for the possibility of recounting the story that what we're doing is that's parallel to the question of should we be performing rather than studying? Here, I think it's specifically meant as a response to the destruction and something unique about the night of the 15th, rather than thinking about it as a more general subset of this question of whether we're supposed to study or do. That would be my inclination, would be maybe to separate this question out from that dichotomy. Okay, I think I hit all the questions. I don't know if there are any.
No, just the last Susanna's point about the songs were meant as an appendix. Can be done anytime. I always.
I didn't get to the last. Oh, I didn't see it. Okay. I also read that the songs in the back are actually an appendix, not meant to be done at the end, but can be accessed as needed, desired during the Seder. Interesting. That's very interesting. I've never heard that, but certainly makes a lot of sense. That would certainly, to the extent that that's the case. So my attempt to connect those songs with the practice of Epikomadzein would certainly not be possible. So, but thank you.
I always thought it was a way to keep the kids' interest up, and
right.
Maybe that works with the appendix.
That story about the Chachamim studying all night and then going to the Beit HaMidrash, that somehow seems like an exaggeration. I mean, you can't be up all night and then, you know, proceed to the Beit HaMidrash. You know, at that point you're wasted.
Right. So I think that's right. I guess one way to understand that would be, you know, as if to say the rabbis have been, you know, they feel like out of their elements being in the house. And what they're doing is they're almost rushing back to the familiar confines of the Beit HaMidrash, which is another way of saying what we're doing here is so different and so unfamiliar that when the rabbis get the very first opportunity, the cock crows, the night is done, what do? They rush off to the Beit HaMidrash. So you're right, there's something maybe a little bit implausible about that, but I think maybe what you're putting your finger on is exactly the point here, which is the rabbis really feel out of their element, and what we're doing is telling them, and nonetheless, this is very important that this is, you know, that this is the different practice on this night, different from all other nights, not in the Beit HaMidrash. You want to go back to the Beit HaMidrash, rush there in the morning, but tonight you're situated in the home.
Maybe they went to Daven Vatikin.
Yeah. I myself am very tired at the end of Shavuot night, so I can only imagine how they must have felt sitting around and studying halachot all night. So I have a lot of sympathy.
How about the emphasis on transmission to the children?
What do you mean?
Isn't that the basis of the whole Haggadah? Where, at what stage, in which period was it emphasized?
So I think one way of reading that first Mechilta is to say that that wasn't the general practice, would not have been for all children or all people to engage in Torah study. That may perhaps have been the practice focused on the Chachamim, or perhaps even focused on the wise children. I think for the Tosefta, we could imagine there being, I'm not sure that we have to speak about a historical trajectory, earlier study, later recounting the story. I think we could imagine these as parallel possibilities, both of which arose as possible responses. One possibility embraced in one set of texts, another possibility embraced in another set of texts. From iPad to everyone, that's exactly that's exactly my point. Different versions, different tracks, parallel in time. Exactly.
Thank you.
Going to the Beit Midrash after learning the Hilchot HaPesach all night might be construed as explaining ma, as why, doing a doresh for the tamim of all the laws, as opposed to just ma, listing the laws. So we start right with the ma, what are the laws, and we end up in Lod going to the Beit HaMidrash to find out the answer why.
Ah, interesting. Okay, so we move because we were able to accomplish certain things in the confines of the home, but if we want access to our full library or something like that, or the more familiar sort of discourse, higher level discourse, perhaps we need to retreat back to the Beit HaMidrash, where perhaps the level of Torah study was higher, and therefore we're able to maybe address certain things that couldn't be addressed in the context of the home.
Yes, we combine ma. We combine the two meanings of ma.
Very interesting.
And why?
Very interesting. Thank you.
May I raise one point? If you look at the question of the Chacham in the Torah, and you look at the answer that's given to the Chacham in the Torah in Perek Vav of Sefer Devarim, so his question is Mohedot Vachukim, which would seem to mean why rather than what. Because the answer that the Torah gives to this question is V'yomar Tolu B'incha V'odimo Yinu L'faro B'mitzrayim and so forth. V'yitein Hashem Osotu Mavtim V'otanu Otsi Misham L'man Havi Otanu L'tet Lanu Et Ha'oretz V'yitzavenu Hashem L'asot Et Kol HaChukim Ha'ele U'tzilokoti Elonu K'nishmor L'asot Et Kol HaMitzvah. It seems to be more of telling him the narrative rather than telling him the laws.
Yeah, that's exactly, maybe I wasn't clear. That's exactly the point that I was trying to make about the difference between the Yerushalmi and the Mechilta. The Yerushalmi understands Maver straightforwardly as, you know, why do we do this? Or, you know, what are the reasons behind our doing this? And you can infer from the answer that's given that that's the question, because the answer that's given, like you said, is Abadim Hayinu. It's not a reference to the study of the law, whereas in the Mechilta, which is focused not on the story aspect, but on the study aspect, understands Ma as what are they? 100%, yeah.
But the Torah itself answers the question, and the Torah itself seems to give the narrative rather than the laws.
Yes, and that's why the Mechilta is so interesting, because the Mechilta seems to defy the straightforward reading. And what I'm suggesting is it defies a straightforward reading precisely because their experience of the night, they're reading it through the lens of their experience of the night. Absolutely.
Okay, just one last point we want to just touch upon. I see in the chat box, Carol's asking that if you're doing the halacha, why do you have to ask yourself the questions if it's a question of halacha?
I've always heard the four questions for the unity of celebrity. I would be true if you are just studying the laws. So I think that the four questions that we have in the Haggadah are reflective of this other track, not of study, but rather of telling the story. So remember the difference between, I alluded to the fact that you have this difference between the Braita in the Talmud Bavli and the Braita in the Tosefta. Braita in the Tosefta says, even if you're by yourself, you have to study the law. Right? So that's, if you're studying the law, that's Beino Levein Atzmo. That's by yourself. There's no reference to questions, because for that version, you're not asking the questions of Ma'an Ishtana. Those questions aren't meant to provoke an answer, not meant as the stimulus, the story. Whereas when we talk about the need to ask the questions, even if you're by yourself, that I think is a reflection of this other version of the Braita, namely the version that we have preserved in the Talmud Bavli, which is the questions perhaps are meant as a stimulus to the story. And in the same way that you have to tell the story, that you have to recount to yourself the story, so too in the, do you have to open with the questions that are meant as a stimulus to the telling of the story? So I think that your question is a good one. I think, though, that it's limited to the familiar set of rituals focused on Sipur rather than focused on Luma.
Okay, thank you very much. We'll let you go. We look forward to next week, and have a wonderful week and good things. This evening, of course, Dr. Sokolow, 8 p.m., 3 a.m. in Israel, for those who can't sleep, on the continuing on his translations of Tanakh. Tomorrow morning, Shuli Mishkin finishes her series on archaeology and the Bible. Tomorrow is Shivat Zion and the return and the last prophets. A very appropriate topic, the return to Zion. That's tomorrow at 12 noon Eastern. Tomorrow night, 8:30, Parsha Shir is given by Rabbi Eitan Aviner, who runs the Israel program, teaching here at the Bnei Akiva schools in Toronto. And Friday morning, 9 a.m. is my continuing shiur on the Siddur. And Rabbi Liebtag begins his Pesach series on Sunday, two parts on how Tehillim understood, Magi, that's 11:15. And then Rabbi Kowalski and that's on and Zev Elif continuing on Monday morning, completing their three-part series on Pesach. And Tuesday, Rachel Sharansky, and that's it. Alex Israel finished his series in Elio yesterday. So we look forward to learning with you, and we're back to you next Wednesday morning. I just went through the whole cycle of the week. I think Monday night, Mark Shapiro, of course, continuing the rabbinic response to reform. So we look forward to learning with you. Please invite a friend, and thank you very much. Have a wonderful day, everybody. Okay, bye-bye.